Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 33 of Break the Cycle with me, your host, Joshua Smith. I hope everyone is having a wonderful evening. Let's start off with some sponsors as per the usual. Of course, we have Lorenzotti.coffee for all your delicious Italian coffee needs delivered directly to your door. Bring the taste of Italy home. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. This stuff is amazing. Try it. I promise you won't be disappointed. Of course, TopLobster.com. The man, the myth, the legend, one of my favorite people in the entire world. This guy makes quality stuff like this great Break the Cycle custom embroidered logo hat that I'm wearing. Also, this Ron Paul, It Didn't Have to Be This Way hoodie. And today, I got in the mail this awesome, I'm going to put it up close, Break the Cycle pillow for the Couchstream set. Now, you can have a piece of the Couchstream set on your own couch by ordering one of these. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. And of course, anthemplanning.com. Wonderful people. Use them for all of your emergency and crisis needs, planning needs. They're doing a job that the government sucks at for a much cheaper price and much more efficiently. Check them out. See what they can do for you today. Guys, we've got an awesome show for you today. I'm super, super excited. My guest today is the Florida man. He's the assistant editor at Mises, paleo libertarian. He's the Bay GOP vice chair and the host of Radio Rothbard. He is Tho Bishop. How you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. So glad to join you.
Yeah, me too, man. I'm glad you could make it. You know, I'm a big fan of you. We don't see eye to eye on strategy. We're going to get into a lot of that, but I am still a big fan of yours. I think you do a lot of great things. So I'm very excited to have you on the show, and I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, no, glad to join. And again, you've been doing the best work. Definitely the best looking show in the libertarian sphere. And again, I can't endorse that endorsement of Top Lobster more enough, because the guy out there is a true artist at a time where we definitely need them. So yeah, sure. You've been killing it.
Thanks, man. Well look, 50% of the vibe of my show is Top Lobster. If it wasn't for that man, it wouldn't be half as cool as it is. He did the logos. He does the thumbnails. I mean, everybody who comes on my show gets like a custom hand-drawn picture of themselves. You can't go wrong, you know?
No. Particularly when you're wrestling an alligator. Like, this is, yeah.
You know, hey, you're Florida man. We had to do it. It had to be you wrestling an alligator. It was either that or running naked down the street on meth. I mean, it had to be one of the two things, right?
Yes, I'll take it.
So you're pretty intellectual when it comes to the anarcho-capitalist stuff and libertarian, paleo-libertarian stuff. You didn't just show up one day and be like, I'm a Rothbard guy. I mean, you had to have a journey like most of us. So why don't you explain to us Tho's journey from normie, whatever you were, to assistant editor of Mises and political activist.
Yeah, well, I was born in a very political household, for better or for worse. My father was Buddy Bishop. He wrote the playbook for training young GOP operatives back in the day. My dad was, he had me later in his life, so that helped the time framing here. But my dad was the mentor of like Roger Stone and even Karl Rove. And so I grew up, at my father's knee, like listening to these war stories of campaign, you know, like dirty tricks. It was great. I mean, he was Southern politics as well. He was also before the corporate press was quite as evil as it was now. He actually worked for NBC covering the civil rights era as well down here. And so I was saturated in this very political environment. Then I discovered this Ron Paul guy, you know, in 2008. At the same time, you know, during the financial crisis and things like that, I used to love going in like AOL political chat rooms and, owning the, but before there was owning the libs, like my dad and I would go, we would go bash the libs. And, but I realized that during the financial crisis, I had nothing interesting to say. And I was already kind of reevaluating my views on the Iraq war because that was obviously a disaster. And there was this one guy in a message board, a superhero message board, superherohype.com, that would repeatedly know what was going to happen in the financial sector, like before anyone else did. And he was better than any mainstream journalist out there. Like he just knew, and he was sharing like zero hedge links at the time. And so I eventually just asked this guy, I said, look, how do I get to know what you know? Because I hated not having an opinion. And he sent me a copy of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. And I started reading down there. And then I started reading more widely. And then this guy named Murray Rothbard just kept showing up. And his work was just so interesting and so compelling. And so I really got in the Austrian economic sphere. And you know, back when we had an oil spill here in Bay County, I had a job where we were cleaning up oil, you know, tar balls from the beach. And like OSHA regulations, like it was a 12-hour a day, 7 days a week job, but you could only work like so long when the heat got to a certain level because of OSHA. And so I had all this time to just read books. And so I got so much reading done while working during this oil spill. And I started writing about this Austrian school because I found the work so fascinating. And one of my dad's clients was a guy named Spencer Backus, who worked for the financial service, who was a Republican from Birmingham. He became chairman of the Financial Services Committee after the Tea Party Revolution in 2010. And, you know, I had a meeting with him. I told him about the Austrian school and about how they predicted things when no one else did. I wrote out a summary, you know, like it was like a 10-page summary of their views of the financial crisis. And from that, he hired me up to Washington, D.C. And, you know, I was a college dropout working in a coffee shop and, you know, down here in Panama City at the time. And from there, I got to know Ron Paul's staff because he was on the committee. And so that was a dream come true, you know, going from literally the same week, you know, come down here after being a barista and I'm walking this marble building and I could see Ron Paul tee off against Ben Bernanke. And it was just incredible. And I got to know his staff very well. Like I know Jeff Dice, who was the chief of staff at the time. And I ran for state house here in Bay County in 2014. And after I was not successful there, shortly thereafter, you know, Jeff asked, you know, was looking to fill his communication staff at the Institute. And so since 2015, I've been working at the best organization in the world, working to, you know, having the opportunity to write and have a platform there, and then also get to know and work with and promote the work of some brilliant young scholars that we have in the Austrian tradition. And so I've been living my best life, you know, because of all this. You know, I get to work for a job that, you know, there's no other organization out there that I think is more important. And I get to work with people who I think work matters. And I get to deal in the ideas that I think are vital to rebuilding civilization. And so that's kind of my journey. It's been an incredible thing. And I've had a tremendous amount of luck and got to know a lot of the great people along the way. And all of it has led here on this couch stream. So that's got a little bit of my background there.
Nice. You're at the pinnacle now talking to me,
yeah.
You know,
this absolutely. Is, yeah.
Tom Woods. Who's
cartoon
that?
Form.
Oh, Paul, yeah. What? Huh? Get out of here.
Well, there's a peak of any career really. I think it's when you make it into the cartoon form. So this is peak for Tom, peak for Michael, and now peak for me.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just reached out to Tom and Jeff recently about having them on the couch stream. So hopefully one or both will come on at some point, I hope. Speaking of anarcho, you know, the anarcho-capitalist and mm-hmm. Austrian tradition especially, I mean, there's been some really great philosophers and economists involved in that tradition. You know, especially Murray. I think Murray, for me, was, I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for A New Liberty. I mean, that book, I opened that book and it was a window that I could never close again. What was the first one that you read that you were like, wow, this is everything?
I'm trying to think of my first Rothbard article. I will say that one of those articles that was just a changing of reality to me was reading it. It was an Ayn Rand article. And it was called, I think it was something like Let Us Alone, but it was about the history of the word laissez-faire.
Oh, sure.
And because I was reading this at like the 2009 Obama era. And so this essay is fantastic because it was critiquing and commenting on the president trying to pass a stimulus package. And like, and it's not until like the last page of the article where it references President Johnson rather than the president. And that's where my mind was completely blown, because like, man, like you could take this article from, you know, 1960s and run it here now in 2009. And like, we haven't learned a damn thing.
Right.
And that, like, once you start recognize, like, you know, There's a lot in the history side of it that's also been a red pill. Like I know like the Tom Woods and Gutsman's book on like who killed the Constitution is just great at like killing, like reframing your view of American history in particular. But like once I think that you know, once you really get down the economic rabbit hole, then it allows you to really scrutinize all the state action that we've had in the last 100+ years. And that's something where, you know, that's when I started recognizing just how powerful all this sort of stuff is. And so that's the one article that I can, you know, I can, that's when everything changed. That was my red pill. That was probably the red pill for me, was that Ayn Rand article. But there's so much by Murray. I mean, his sense of humor coupled with his not only incredible economic brilliance, where he made genuine traditions of the economic school, his history is wonderful. And I think the narrative of history is so powerful in communicating ideas far more than pure theory can. You know, it's just he was such a but his work as a political strategist as well, the fact that he's someone who wasn't simply content to being an ivory tower, was actually winning a brawl, and he made a lot of enemies for it. But that's the thing that we are so blessed, and I don't think we've properly realized someone of his intellect being so hands-on in the political sphere. And that's one of the best assets that we as libertarians have, is building on the shoulders of that giant right there.
Sure. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's, you know, if it wasn't for Murray, I probably wouldn't be in the Libertarian Party, which I know is kind of weird to you, right? But, you know, I believe that there's still those traditions in the Libertarian Party that Murray brought to it. It just needed a revival. And that's why I work with the Mises-Cox. That's why I think that, you know, they are reviving that tradition in the Libertarian Party per se. But you obviously have a difference of opinion when it comes to strategy with the Libertarian Party and the Republican Party. You work with the Republican Party. And for me, I was a Republican. I was actually a neocon, if you can believe that. You know, I joined the military right after September 11th and decided I was going to go and protect my country's freedoms in the Middle East. You know, I don't know how they got there. And that really is what red-pilled me was going to war. I came home. I didn't find support for my values anymore in the Republican Party until I found Ron Paul in 2007. I worked on Ron Paul's campaign in 2008. If you're familiar, he endorsed me for chairman of the Libertarian Party last year, which was just, I mean, so insanely special to me. But the Republicans left me after the Ron Paul campaigns. I mean, they left me. They showed me personally that that liberty wasn't their cause, you know. And so I guess my question for you would be, why the Republican Party? And is it really just because it's more effective?
Well, it's really not that. That's part of it, but it's really not that, because it's always difficult to try to peel off all of the layers to it, because my view on the pure party structure tactics is not simply based off and this is where I think where I differ a bit from others. My position is not simply that the Republican Party is more effective than the Libertarian Party. My opinion is that a libertarian movement is counterproductive for libertarian ideas, that there's no value in libertarian unity, and that when libertarians try to create something on their own, they are diminishing the value of libertarian ideas, because libertarianism is not enough for a movement in itself, because libertarianism is a thin political philosophy. And so that's kind of I have kind of a little bit of a revisionist take on like the Ron Paul revolution and really American politics of the last 30 years. I even disagree with Dr. Hoppe on the paleo history, which is very arrogant for me, considering I was in diapers at the time Hoppe was there. But I think I'm justified in doing so, because I think that the Ron Paul movement to me was a continuation of the paleo strategy in the 90s. And I say that because while Buchanan lost his presidential, and I'm sorry, I'm going long-winded, and I hope this.
No, please do.
I think this was just the point. You know, while it's true that Pat Buchanan's campaign lost in 92 and 96, and it's also important to actually point out that Lou Rockwell was not a 100% Pat Buchanan guy in 96. He was also very favorable to Steve Forbes.
True.
While those campaigns did not succeed, there was a very important campaign that did succeed in 1996, and that was Ron Paul, his return to Congress.
Right.
And that was a very tight election. And it's because when Ron ran the first time, he was known to be a principled guy. But he was the country doctor, right? He was the guy that delivered the babies. By the time that 96 came around, he was known as being the radical libertarian Ron Paul. And that's harder to win in like Jackson. And so it was it was Ron Paul's orbit, which was always Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard and all of that group. They were able to build a nationwide apparatus, and Ron Paul knew how to appeal to average Republicans. And I think the problem is that the Ron Paul revolution inspired a liberty movement. And I think that as us as libertarians, we have a lot of nostalgia for that liberty movement because it was a lot of fun. We found a common cause. We met a lot of people online. We would go to events and conventions. We'd have thousands of people, and we thought we were going to change the world, and we didn't. It failed. It failed terribly, and it failed in part because Rand Paul, who was the best senator in the country, is not his father, and that's the. But the problem is that I don't think the liberty movement is a politically effective force on its own. Libertarians in politics have traditionally benefited more on the right side generally. But even Ron's strength, I think, came as much from his strong Christian ethic rather than simply his libertarian ethos. And I don't think that you can ignore that aspect to it. And so that's kind of my larger conversation here, is that I think the libertarian movement is a problem for libertarian ideas, because I think it ends up pushing everything on our very narrow view of our political arrangements. And it necessarily ties our hands behind our back on the larger cultural issues, because once we start getting the cultural issues, that pushes us right or left. And that's always where the division lies.
Sure.
And the problem I believe in the Rothbardian theory view of history of liberty versus power. The problem is that if you don't have a cultural lens to view that from, then people's definition of liberty changes dramatically. What the left considers liberty is very different than what we consider liberty. And simultaneously, power is changed. In my own version, my own opinions of power have changed. Given I can't see power simply through a state lens, given the rise of corporate tyranny. But that's the whole thing, though, is that like you need more than simply an understanding of political theory. That political theory ends up being a framework that reflects your larger cultural views. And so we are not a united movement. We have libertarian views that can contribute to the cultural outcomes of the left and the right, but we are not a unified movement. And so my larger debate over the GOP versus the LP is a reflection of that in politics. And it's also why I encourage culturally left libertarians to go on the Democratic side and try to outwoke the left. God bless you. Cory Massimino, if he was out there going to the Democrats, I would support that entirely.
Sure.
And so that's where I think the larger disagreement about parties is a superficial part of my larger kind of view there on libertarian movements beyond simply the ballot box.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's still kind of hard for me to wrap my head around it, because we have had great people in the Republican mm-hmm. Party. You know, I'm a fan of Thomas Massie. I was mostly a fan of Justin Amash. I still think Justin Amash was one of the greatest congressmen, that we've had in the last, I don't know, 30 years or something, besides Ron Paul and a few others. And Rand Paul, of course, I think is great on most things. I don't agree with him on everything, obviously, but I know that he has to work a certain way to get certain things done. But I've watched them kind of these liberty Republicans, right? Is what we want to call them, like Austin Peterson, right? Like I've been friends with Austin Peterson for a while. We talk sometimes. I've hung out on his dad's ranch in Missouri. But when it came down to it, the GOP treated him like absolute garbage, pretty bad. And they kind of, I mean, it seems to me like the congressmen that do get elected that are liberty based Republicans, they really can't get a lot done because the GOP mm-hmm. doesn't really agree with those forms of liberty. So it's always been kind of hard for me to wrap my head around ever since the Ron Paul campaign, especially,
Well, I think the issue there is, I think, there's a few different things of looking at it. For one of the things that's the defining characteristic from all the libertarian congressmen, and I think liberty Republican congressmen, and I think this is something that libertarians often take for granted, is that they were more than simply liberty.
Sure.
Right. They were well respected. I mean, again, Ron Paul was awfully a very well respected doctor. Thomas Massie was a very well respected engineer and a county level. He was basically the county level mayor, more or less, not quite those terms. And then, Justin Amash was a state rep, so he was able to build his way up. And I think the problem with someone like like Austin. And the problem with Austin is that, and again, I've come to really respect where he's at. I think Austin has grown a lot, and I like seeing that. I love seeing people grow, and Austin's done that. And so I've become a big fan of his, but I was very anti his Senate campaign in 2018. Cause I saw it as a vanity project.
Republican, you had Josh Hawley, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not even just because that, because there's a finite amount of Liberty Capital out there for political and things. Like if you're going from the LP, very public, you know, and again, I respect his ambition running for the LP nomination there. It needs to be pointed out that Austin Peterson, 2016, got some of the most important, got some of the most weighty endorsements of any Libertarian candidate race. Again, that is something, regardless of anything else, is a respectable achievement. The problem is that when you jump from the LP to the GOP, and like he wasn't just in the LP in 2016. I mean, he was very anti-Trump. So we're gonna have some co-hosts here.
The chat is all talking about your cat right now.
Oh yeah, his mama cat right there. She came with the house. We did not own a cat in Auburn, and then we came here, and she was pregnant when we moved in, and then so that's a whole other thing. So she came with the house, but so Austin, you know, was very hostile to Trump, and so you can't run for Senate 2 years after when you have obviously that doesn't work. And so what it was, and again, I respect the game, but like, you know, it was him building his name recognition, which is fine. But the problem is, it's I'm not surprised, for example, the Missouri GOP kind of looked at him with suspicion because it was a suspicious looking move, right? You know, he's not running off of, you know, like that's fair. Sure. I think
Libertarian Party would have treated Bill Weld the same way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The additional issue though is that if you only look at like the GOP, I think on the national scale is totally compromised. Perhaps structurally, perhaps intentionally so, perhaps it's just well-intentioned, whatever, I don't know. But the GOP nationally is an embarrassment. And I've never defended it as such. I think that there are interesting elements in the national GOP. Like I think if Jim Jordan was leader, I think the GOP would be much better overnight. I think Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene are two of the best members of Congress. And I would take Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz over a generic libertarian Republican congressman because they know how to work the rallies. They know how to work the excitement. And they also question narratives that need to be questioned. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene sounds like the Libertarian Party of Kentucky right now, right? I mean, sure. she got very strongly worded about it. But like, you know, that's I think those are positive developments. But the national GOP is worthless.
Sure.
Where it's not worthless, though, and this is where I get frustrated with the way this conversation goes sometimes, is that if you look at the state level, the idea that Republicans don't reduce government is a lie, because Republicans, given the powers of state government, often do reduce it. We've seen, I mean, Tennessee got rid of its income tax a few years ago. Like, sure. That's a big deal, right? Ron DeSantis, I think it speaks for himself. I know you'll have libertarians.
We're going to have a whole segment on DeSantis. Don't worry. We're going to talk about your buddy. I promise.
Excellent. So, but get across the 9 out of 10 of the states with lowest taxes in the country are red.
Sure.
The one blue is Colorado
and Washington.
The freest economies in terms of regulation, red, right? Colorado being the one exception. While I understand like the response is like, oh, well, drug laws. Well, it's easier to avoid drug laws in a red state than it is easier to avoid tax laws in a blue state. You know, so that's I don't like this idea that, oh, well, blue and red are the same. They're not. They're fundamentally not. And anyone, if your analysis in the political spectrum is assuming they are, then you are lying to yourself to draw a conclusion. And I think we as libertarians, we can't afford lying to ourselves for comfort. We're fighting the most important battle in civilization. It's us versus the state, and we can't afford to lie to make ourselves more comfortable on the powers that be, because it's easier that way. And I think there's a lot of libertarians that prefer to tell themselves convenient lies than deal with the reality of the power.
So here's my thing too: is it a lie, or is it that, you know, the Republican state, the red states, right? States, and somebody actually mentioned it in Charlie Baker in the chat, and mm-hmm. how one of the worst governors in the country.
Oh, sure. Yeah, screw them.
So I know you're talking about state legislators and all kinds of stuff, not just governors. But we will get into your friend Ron DeSantis, I promise. Is it lying to herself, or is it that there's some laws and stuff that go on in blue states that some libertarians may be more comfortable with than the laws and stuff they have to deal with in red states?
if you care about if you would rather be locked down in your home and be free to buy weed from the corner store,
sure,
then California was better than Florida. If that's your priority, fine. And again, I'm not a universalist by any means. If there are certain and you know, this is why, like, I fully support blue states, you know, radicalizing the liberalism, you know, in the leftist sense. That's I think the beauty of the decentralist framework. But if that's, you know, if the priorities of blue states on cultural issues matter more to you than, let's say, for simplicity's sake, economic libertarian issues, okay, fine. That's, you know, but I think it's a mistake. The problem is, though, is that don't, so therefore, in those situations, if you want to try to make the tax environment a little bit better or the regulatory environment a little bit better, my suggestion would not be to join the GOP. It would be to show your culturally left flag and let it fly and let that define you, and then try to work in economics on the side while being a Democrat.
True.
I'm under no delusion that, you know, libertarians are all going to be united behind a cultural flag, and that's precisely why I favor a separation as much as possible. I think decentralization within the liberty movement is just as useful as decentralization within the political sphere.
The nation. Yeah. Are you a fan of the national divorce?
Yes. I'm a Florida nationalist. I'm gonna throw that out there. Yeah, absolutely.
nice. Well, it's funny because I hear Michael Miles talk a lot about national divorce, and I totally am on board 100%. But mm-hmm. prior to that, Adam Kokesh was talking about localization, getting the government mm-hmm. down to the very smallest yes. level possible. He wrote a whole bunch about it. You know, it's probably the thing I agree with the most with Adam Kokesh is localization, because then, you know, if you do have an issue with you know, a red state having this or mm-hmm. that and this or that, you can go to this other blue state or whatever it is and deal with whatever tyranny it is that you like there. But yeah, I think the national divorce is really important. And we're going to talk a little bit about Ron DeSantis. I know you're mm-hmm. a fan. I like a lot of the stuff that Ron has done as well. You know, I'm not going to lie and say that, you know, oh, he's a Tibet. You know, I think he's done some really good things. I think Florida really handled this COVID bullshit pretty well. I was lucky enough. I actually, you know, I'm from California though.
Mm-hmm.
And I left California 5 minutes before they instituted a 24-hour lockdown in March of last year. I moved to Iowa, and Iowa's been great. They did do a kind of half-assed shutdown for about a month, and then mm-hmm. Reynolds did a mask mandate for about 2 months, but no one followed it. No one gave a shit. You could walk in any store you wanted without mm-hmm. a mask. Now she has made it completely illegal, signed into law, made it illegal to have any mask mandate. So
great.
And so for, you know, for a libertarian, most libertarians are like, hey, you can't support
right.
that shit. I'm like, yes, I can. I can yeah. support whatever I want. I think, you know, I don't want to have all the restaurants and the grocery stores and shit around here telling me, hey, if you don't cover your face, you can't come into our business and buy food for your children. Well, okay. Well, now you're fucking with my kids. Right.
Right.
And so I was really, you know, I actually supported it. I did. And mm-hmm. people can call me not a libertarian, but what was it about Ron? I mean, what was it that you liked so much about Ron DeSantis and how he handled all this shit in Florida?
Well, for one, I think it's important to understand, like, I've been following DeSantis for a while. I was a big supporter of his in 2018, not less because of DeSantis, but because of his enemy, who was Adam Putnam, who was the absolute embodiment of the worst parts of the Bush Republican Party. You know, like, awful. Right. He was like the youngest state rep in Florida. He was a young Republican, you know, all-star, became a congressman when he was, you know, in his mid-20s. Voted for, you know, every war, voted for cash for clunkers, which should have been an easy gimme, voted for the light bulb ban. It was awful. And DeSantis ran a terrible primary campaign. Putnam got all the endorsements in the state. If you were active in Florida politics prior to 2015, you were all, you know, 99% behind Putnam. And then three Donald Trump tweets led Ron DeSantis to crushing Adam Putnam by 20 percentage points.
Jeez.
And that is the most underappreciated moment of, like, modern political history. Cause, like, that's when I recognized the Trump phenomenon for what it was, and what the Trump flag gave Republicans smart enough to use it was a weapon against the worst parts of state politics. And so, but DeSantis, when he was in Congress, was interesting because he was a member of the Freedom Caucus. So he himself, you look at his voting record, he's got some interesting stuff. He's really good on vocational training and things like that. But for the most part, I mean, it is a mediocre to slightly above average, given the scales of Republican politics in DC record. But he was in the Freedom Caucus, so he surrounded himself with the right people. And then when he won his election, his Sherpa in Tallahassee was Matt Gaetz. Because Ron DeSantis, when he came in, Ron DeSantis was an outsider. And so was Rick Scott. And I'm not the biggest Rick Scott fan in the world, but I think that it is important that Florida's last two governors were outsiders, outside of the state political system. I think it's easy to compare, for example, Florida to Texas or Florida to New York or Texas to California. I think it's more useful to compare Florida to Texas because Texas is a state coasting off its reputation, whereas Florida's thriving. And a big part of that is that Texas's politics are very internally controlled. The last 30 years, only one governor from Texas did not come from a statewide office. That was W.
Right.
And same for lieutenant governor, he's even more powerful. So Florida was a disrupting force in Tallahassee when you bring in a new outsider. And Matt Gaetz was a Sherpa. And Matt Gaetz is someone who I'm a big fan of. I think Matt Gaetz is the best vision for the Republican Party that I've seen expressed out there. That includes even Thomas Massie. There's no one out there I think has expressed a better vision. And so he has this uncanny knack of surrounding himself with the people that I like. And then his first battle when he became governor was fighting his own Republican Party over some stupid attempt to regulate loose leaf marijuana, medical marijuana, after the voters voted like 70-30 in favor of it. He had his alliance during the campaign. He had the support of a lot of environmentalists because he was anti-big sugar cronyism, which is a big deal down the Everglades and pollution down there. And he also got black mothers in Tallahassee to support him over Gillum, which considering it's a 33,000 vote election is pretty significant because of his commitment to school choice. And so like his record, again, it's not libertarian, but it was interesting. He had a knack for things. And then seeing him become the man that he is now during COVID, it's rare to see a politician genuinely develop,
sure,
genuinely improve. Most people don't have the if you've gone from Congress to the governorship, chances are your ego is large enough to make it difficult to change.
Sure.
But DeSantis did. He was one of the biggest resistors of locking down, and all he locked down because Trump asked him to, because the political polling sucked.
Right.
Because Florida not shutting down during COVID was hard to do in Florida when you have a presidential campaign going on, because cities in Florida are multiple times larger than the entire state of South Dakota.
Sure.
And so you've got a lot of scared old people that listen to nothing but the mainstream media. My great aunt, she's 95. She hates taxes as much as any good ANCAP, but she was scared to death of COVID, for one, because she was 95, sure, and two, because she's listening to mainstream media. And she votes, and she was not happy. Like, she was scared. These people were scared. And it's hard to do that when your voters are scared.
Right.
And but the thing is, he learned. He dealt with the science. He created an entire parallel scientific expertise base around him. Some of the people that are featured in Tom Woods' show, Scott Atlas from Stanford,
sure, yeah,
a lot of the great Barrington signers, things like that. And so he recognized the DC policy experts are lying. They're not simply giving bad policy. They are lying. And he stood up to that. That's powerful.
Right.
He's been taken on the media because the media was misrepresenting things. He recognizes the danger of the media. And in the last year, Florida has taken significant steps on taking out the worst, not all, the worst of leftist indoctrination in our public school system. They're getting serious about some of the abuses in higher academia. And so here you have a Republican governor that's taken on the DC policy expert establishment, who has taken on the media, who is taking on the universities, who is taking, and also made me one of the freest people in the civilized world. He's not a libertarian, but he has done more for my liberty than any other politician in American history during my lifetime.
True.
And so to me, when I hear libertarians try to critique DeSantis off of like, oh, well, he doesn't want to legalize marijuana tomorrow, it's like, okay, that'd be great, but I'm not going to be ungrateful for the fact that I've been one of the freest people. Living in a free world is more important to me than critiquing someone. You know, actually, libertarian theory says, I don't want to live in theoretical Facebook discussions about debate about libertarian theory. I want to live in a free society. And I was able to go to a dive bars in May of 2020 without a mask.
Are you sick to death of pussyfooting around the truth while being constantly fed lies by news and big tech tyrants? If so, then come join me, Dan Smotz, on The System Is Down, where we get weird, have fun, and dig into all the dangerous taboo topics like conspiracies, politics, religion, culture, current events, and everything your family just prays you don't bring up around the Thanksgiving dinner table. And I know that reality is scary to some people, so if you're easily offended, just ignore this and go back to making cat memes or whatever. But if you're ready to change the world for the better, come join me on The System Is Down at tsidpod.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's tsidpod.com, because the system is down and truth is taking over.
And be surrounded by people just like me. And that's something I could not have done in most states in this union.
Sure.
Or the world.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. It was for me, initially it was Kristi Noem. You know, I was like, oh, Kristi Noem. And then when she actually like vetoed the vote for,
yeah.
I couldn't, there was nothing else. Like I could not, yeah. I could no longer defend her after that. I mean that, you know, the drug war is a big deal to me. Don't get me wrong. I think it's gotta be one of the top issues for libertarians, sure. Because it does lock people in cages all over the country for victimless crimes and in violent rape cages. I mean, it's a bad thing. It's a very bad thing.
And it justifies an increase of the state in ways beyond it victimizes those that aren't drug users. Not that drug users should be victimized, but the victims go much broader.
Well, and I think it was Scott Horton that I had on the show that really kind of opened my mind to the drug war is also a war on gun owners. Mm-hmm. Because they can give you a federal charge if they pick you up, you got weed on you and you have a gun on you, they can give you a federal charge. Now it becomes this big huge gun rights issue, and there's so many layers to the drug war that people don't even understand. Right. It is a big topic for libertarians, and it's not just because we want to get high. A lot of us do want to get high. I get that. But it goes a lot deeper. But yeah, I'm the same way. Like, you know, I live in Iowa. They're still arresting people for simple possession of CBD here. Mm. Not just pot, not loosely for what we just call it flower, bud. I'm just,
right.
just so you know.
Right.
But for CBD, I mean, this thing that has been proven and used for all kinds of different shit all over the country. But at the end of the day, yeah, I've been able to go to bars and restaurants. And we went to Adventureland once with the kids. And it was, you know, they don't require masks. There's no 6-foot rule. It's like, and nobody got sick. And so it was pretty cool. It's pretty cool to live in a state like that. So I totally get the feeling, you know what I mean? Like it's not anything crazy. We got a super chat from Quest Fanning. Thanks a lot, buddy. He said, how about we find a state or country that is a sanctuary from federal income tax? Yes, please. Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
That's like Puerto Rico.
Yeah, there you go. And it's nice there. You can have the beach too. It's not.
Yeah,
it's not much.
Go join Peter Schiff down in Puerto Rico. And that's also like the Puerto Rico statehood stuff is such a disgusting, cynical play by the left, because they have no problem massively destroying the quality of life of people in Puerto Rico for political power, for perceived political power.
Oh, sure.
And if you start making Puerto Ricans pay the income tax, like it's awful.
Well, let's be honest. The left has shown that they're willing to smash anybody in this country for anything. Even completely hypocritical reasons that go absolutely antithetical to their own, their own admitted principles. Mm-hmm. They don't have any, but the either stuff that goes completely antithetical to stuff they say they support, they will still stomp on that just for political power. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I don't view the Republicans, most Republicans, as much different, but you know, what are you going to do? There's some good ones, and I obviously align more with the Republican Party and a lot of Republicans than I do the Democrats. So
the problem is the Republican Party doesn't do it enough, because the Republican Party doesn't know what it stands for.
Well, there's that too. Yeah.
Like, because that's the issue is that, like, this has come up, I think, with like the big tech issue. Like you have, you know, very, very intelligent libertarians and all the Cato crowd. It's funny. You go look at how, what Cato's commentary on DeSantis's COVID
Oh, their
policies are.
I'm not going
to. And then contrast it to the way they cover his big tech stuff.
Yeah.
But you have someone like Justin Amash yesterday. I'm a Republican, so I get to call out people like Justin Amash. He had a tweet yesterday about like, oh, right wing statism and left wing statism are equally bad, and anything that's about infringing upon the property, the private property rights of businesses is that's not free speech, that's not liberty, and it's. So here you have Justin Amash trying to act like Facebook and Twitter are in no way different than a mom and pop shop. Now, I get that there's brevity in Twitter that can't give you nuance. I'm fine. But this is the problem with libertarians in general, because like the idea that increasing consumer protections on big tech companies that arbitrarily enforce their policies in order to restrict certain political thought. To argue that this is an organic market creation is wrong. It's a lie.
Sure.
And the problem is that it ends up destroying. I mean, it's like Frederick Bastiat, right? He talked about the danger of good positions argued poorly, and how it destroys the position better than a good argument against it. That's what you have. If you have people that are out there waving the flag of free markets and capitalism, while being blind to the way that the left has aligned the interest of state and global corporations, and something like giving consumers who are customers stronger transparency protections on whether or not they're going to be discriminated for voicing a certain political opinion. We're not talking about egregious, but we're talking about political opinions. We're not talking about merits on censoring bad behavior. If your reflex is like, oh, private property rights, it's like that's not enough. Like, these companies do not exist because of private property rights. These are not market creations, and I think that and that does not justify 230 repeal. I think 230 repeal is a bad idea. It does not justify any open season against corporations to do whatever the hell you want. The problem is that if we have libertarians, if we don't find our inner Jackson and go to war against state privilege and identify the enemy as the enemy, then we're going to end up having no voice on the right, and we're going to end up with Teddy Roosevelt progressive populism.
Sure,
and guess what? That's a lot worse. And so that's up to us. Do we want to deal with the world as it exists, or do we want to preach and act self-righteous as if we are the only ones that have any good ideas and talk about an ivory tower model of the way businesses operate? And I think that there's a lot of libertarians that do. I'm just not one of them.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm with you on that as well. I mean, I've talked quite a bit about how especially these big tech companies, right? They're not just free market creations, like you said. They're not. They're absolutely not. They have had all kinds of tax incentives. They've been subsidized with our tax money. Some of these companies have been bailed out in times of crisis while the rest of us were left to starve. They shouldn't be banning the people off who helped keep them afloat off their platforms. And I agree fully, and you're right. It's not just about egregious things. If you tell somebody, oh, I got banned from Facebook, you tell somebody on the left, oh, I got banned from Facebook, they're going to say, good, you were probably spouting racist or misogynistic, right, or xenophobic or whatever word they're using for the day, rhetoric. But we know that that's not the truth. Right. We probably just showed support for President Trump at the time, or we said we didn't believe in lockdowns, or just stupid shit.
I think you were penalized for questioning whether or not the virus came from a Wuhan lab.
I got removed back in October for life from Facebook for saying the same thing that Dr. Fauci.
Funny how that happened.
Is now saying publicly. Yeah, pretty crazy. We're living in a time where things you heard last week were conspiracy theories are now this week true. I mean, it's from one week to the next. I just posted about this on Twitter, how Dr. Fauci last week was saying we never gave money from the NIH to the Wuhan lab. And this week he's justifying why they had to give money to the Wuhan lab as the NIH, which just blows my mind that from one week he's telling the American public, no, we didn't do that. The next week, he's justifying why they did that. And those same people who have been supporting Fauci since the beginning are telling me, you have to listen to everything this man says. You have to submit to these people. You have to let them do what they need to do to fix things. And I'm like, look at the last 2 weeks of this person and tell me that this is the person you should we should be listening to and submitting to in general. It just blows my mind, man. It's just so disgusting, really.
Now, Fauci should be arrested and charged for crimes against humanity. The cost of his lockdown. I mean, he's a fraud. He's admitted to lying multiple times to the American people. The problem is that we accept it because America is not a democracy, it's a technocracy, and it's this managerial class, and these people, there's no consequences. But like Fauci should be tried, and he should be treated as an enemy of the people, because that's what he did. And we have to get serious about this sort of stuff. I mean, like it's the beauty of it is that the one group of people that understand this the best are Republicans right now. So your average Republican voter has, I think, and based on my experience, is a far more radical view of Fauci and of President Biden and of the legitimacy of this entire process than a lot, I'm not going to say most, but a lot of libertarians out there.
If
you're not already like a state is illegitimate, you know, like, you know, an ANCAP, if you're not already an ANCAP, your average Republican voter is closer to an ANCAP than your average minarchist DC libertarian.
The Beltway libertarians.
Yeah. Yeah. You have 70% of Republicans that believe that Joe Biden has no democratic legitimacy.
Sure.
Now again, ignore. Yeah, if you simply okay, so this is not the same as having a argument that no democracy is legitimate, right? So that's closer to that viewpoint than the libertarians out there mocking Trump supporters for questioning the election.
Right.
And that goes into some of my larger the paleo strategy stuff, because like I think the element of the electorate that has been the most radicalized in the last year with the numbers is your average normie Republican. It's not your libertarian. It's not even your anarchists are already radical. I don't think there's massively expanded in size. So I'm happy to see Michael Mouse's book doing as well as it is. I think when you have 50 million normie Republicans that know Donald Trump won the 2020 election, that is the largest, most radical army we've had relative to the population than 1776.
Yeah, since the American Revolution.
That's a lot. I mean, that number of people. This is a different era, and we should, like, there's so many people that don't appreciate the significance of that. I mean, anatomy of the state is not simply talking about why the state is bad. It is an analysis of where the state derives its power. It's about the perception of legitimacy of the people. And here you have 50 plus million people, your average Republican, that questions that power. That's it.
True.
That's the biggest thing out there. And they're losing faith of all of the federal institutions. You know, they don't trust the presidency, obviously. They don't like most Republicans in Congress, much less the Democrats. They're losing faith in the Supreme Court because they won't take up Trump election issues. They've lost faith in the FBI and the CIA, and they're now losing faith in the military because of the wokeness, the indoctrination of that institution. That is the most exciting libertarian development that we've had, regardless of the opinion of your average anti-Biden 50 plus million Trump supporter on recreational heroin. And the fact that so many libertarians don't appreciate that and don't recognize that what that can do for state sovereignty and political decentralization. Like, why are we arguing about a third party when that's sitting there? That's there. Like, that's, we didn't have to build it. It's sitting there. Like, why would we consider anything else?
True.
It's crazy.
Well, you know, I think what it comes down to, and you know, stop me if you think I'm wrong here. I'm not a Beltway libertarian by any means. Mm-hmm. Not my thing. I'm not a Cato guy. I'm obviously a Mises guy. And I agree a lot more with Republicans than I ever will with Democrats. It's just how I've been that way my whole life. But I also see that a lot of those, you know, when you look at that 50 million people, a lot of those people are asking for a different flavor of tyranny, right? And so for some libertarians, they're like, it's all tyranny. It's all tyranny. So I get the sentiment. But what really drives me the most insane about this whole thing, right? The election scandal, the people who, you know, what really drives me crazy are libertarians that are like, no, there was no election fraud. Like, right. As libertarians, right. We know that there's election fraud.
Right.
We know that there's election fraud in the Obama era. We know that there's election fraud in the Bush Jr. era. We know that there was election fraud in the Clinton era. It's been going on for as long as I've been alive. Every year or every election, there's some kind of election fraud found out. So to just say that now all of a sudden, because you hate Trump, there is no election fraud.
Right.
Is just, it baffles me to even think a libertarian could sit down and actually say that with a straight face, regardless of who the president was.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you just look at the history of that election, the number of last second changes to election law, the unorthodox means of handling ballots, I mean, the fact that you had massive vote by mail, which is very regularly understood to be a more susceptible means of voter fraud than anything else. You know, if any libertarian that gives the assumption, the benefit of the doubt to the state when it comes to counting ballots, particularly in the 2020 election, where so many people in powerful positions made it clear that they thought Trump was a threat to humankind.
Sure.
Right. Why wouldn't you take those people seriously? And like, if you literally thought that you could stop Hitler from changing a few ballots, wouldn't you? What moral human being would not commit voter fraud if you thought the alternative was literally Hitler?
Sure.
And so, like, all you have to do is just take the left seriously, which I know can be difficult at times, but you should. Like, they're very clear about what they want, if you listen to them enough. And, well,
they say the quiet part out loud quite frequently.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what makes all that so silly.
Sure.
But the beauty of it is that I don't have to associate with most libertarians. And any libertarian like that is instantly those are now on the modal libertarian list, which is, there's a great article that I'll be publishing tomorrow from Murray Rothbard and the Why Paleo Strategy, where he outlines not only the reasons for right-wing outreach, but the importance of libertarian separatism. And he contrasts a paleo libertarian from a modal libertarian. And so I think that a lot of the people that will be blind to the skepticism of the state counting its ballots properly will find themselves in that modal libertarian camp, which Murray has some very choice words for.
I'm sure. I look forward to reading it. It's funny that word separatism, I always, you know, growing up, you always hear that word is in a bad connotation, right? It's just a bad word. You don't want to talk about separatism. That's obviously a white nationalist thing. And then I had Magnus Panvidia on, right? Who is one of the Boog boys. He was like considered probably one of the king of the Boogs. He's pretty left. He's kind of a mutualist, really. I mean, you know,
okay.
maybe a Benjamin Tucker Proudhon style, but who doesn't give a shit about the woke culture at all. He wants to nothing to do with it. And he goes, yeah, I'm a libertarian separatist. And I was like, huh. And I started kind of thinking about that. I'm like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, dude. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, I've always thought, like, that's where, like, people accuse me of being a sell or something. It's like, oh, I'm working for the Republican Party. How can you be an ANCAP if you work for them? It's because, like, the only way you're ever going to get, like, an ANCAP society, like a truly private government society, in my opinion, at least in the short term, is not going to be privatizing a state. It's going to be an opt-out society. It's going to be a separatist movement. It's going to be seed-setting. It's going to be a private city that you're able to buy from a third world country. It's going to be getting people to opt into it. And it's Gulch, right? Where, you know, that was an opt-in society. The Free State Project, which I kind of, you know, that's an opt-in society. And ultimately, that's the way that you're going to get, the only way you're going to get to, like, a genuinely, like, private law society is going to be through libertarian separatism. The short of that, you're looking for, like, a national liberation movements, and that's what I'm looking for right now. I think the future of American politics is national liberation movements, very similar to the decay of the Soviet Union, and that's where I think one of my favorite controversial statements perhaps is that, like, paleo libertarian Austro libertarian political thought really comes into place when you recognize that Ludwig von Mises was far to the right of Murray Rothbard.
Sure.
And like Rothbard was never as most Misesian in the 90s, particularly like Nations by Consent.
Sure.
And like what he's describing is like the national liberation, what sparked Nations by Consent, which I think is the best libertarian argument for on a view of immigration and nationalism and all that. As a result of national liberation from the Soviet Union. And I think that should be the goal in terms of libertarian operations within the American empire. And I think that, you know, if we do not appreciate nation and community and what entails with that, and we instead just think that we can like turn our community into like Ancapistan overnight, I think that we're missing out on a real opportunity. Because I think strategically that's leave Ancapistan to the opt-outs, the separatists.
Sure.
But dealing with politics as it stands now, we should be embracing our communities and our local cultures in ways that can be politically powerful.
Sure, sure. You almost sounded like Jeff Dice there talking about how blood and soil and all that stuff still means something to people. So
Jeff Dice, I mean, there's not many other libertarian thinkers out there that I think have, you know, I work for the Mises Institute, right? Sure. So I've got to be a propagandist to a certain extent. But Jeff Dice I've learned more from Jeff Dice than I have any other libertarian speaker.
One of the smartest men I've ever heard.
Brilliant. Well, what's kind of cool though is that someone who sounds a lot like Jeff Dice is an old liberal named Gore Vidal.
Oh yeah, sure. I know.
Famous liberal author, novelist, arch enemy of William H. Buckley, and his late end of his life arguments, views on the American political system. He became very, very nationalist. He would talk about how like America is no longer one nation,
sure,
and how America can learn a lot from Switzerland. And he was always very adamantly anti-empire. If anyone out there likes fiction, his historical fiction novels on American history, which is like narratives of empire, starts with Aaron Burr, which is great because like the Satan of the American Revolution, and then moving upwards and how America became an empire. It's fascinating. It makes him. I had a conversation with Lou Rockwell about this recently. Vidal's view of American history is fundamentally Rothbardian. Which is beautiful. I don't think it's intentionally so. I mean, he wasn't reading Rothbard, but it is. And so it's interesting whenever you can see like Diceian political analysis come from someone like Gore Vidal, it's always so much fun because that's the future. Like that's the grown-up solution in the room is the national divorce. It is an appreciation for political decentralization. And anything short of that, like when we get so obsessed with, like national political anything short of that, of understanding the power of political decentralization, it's to me a distraction, because until you fundamentally structure the powers of the American empire, all the discussions about liberty in the world don't matter. We're living in a system subsidized to destroy any idea of rights that we appreciate in a theoretical vacuum.
Sure, sure. Well, man, we're getting really close to the end of the show. I wanted to kind of save this little bit for the end here. So you work with some wonderful people. I mean, some of the greatest people on earth, in my opinion, people like Tom Woods and Jeff Dice and Hoppe. One of my very favorites is Dr. Walter Block. I mean, he's probably one of my favorite people in the world. He has shaped a lot of what I believe in my theory, my political philosophy, my time at working in politics. But So you've had to have heard some really cool stories from some of these guys. And I just want to, I've probably talked about this on the show before, but my favorite story that I've ever heard from any of the fellows from Mises was Dr. Walter Block telling me about how he was this hardcore socialist in college. He was on the track team with Bernie Sanders in college, and they got invited to this luncheon. And he shows up to this luncheon, and there's this woman at the end of the table who's this very righty person, right? And so he goes up to hey, I want to debate you on these topics. And she won't even look at him. And in fact, the guy that was kind of with her, you know, says, here, take this book, go read this book. And when you're done reading this book, come back and she'll have this debate with you. Well, that person was Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. And so you hear that story about Walter Block and you just go, what an amazingly cool fucking story to hear from Walter Block. So is there any stories or anything that's happened since you've been working at the Mises Caucus at the Mises Institute? Sorry, the Caucus and the Institute are not the same thing. I just want to make it clear. That have stuck with you, that you remember, that make you smile.
I'm trying to think of, I mean, the Institute is such a privileged place to work. And, you know, having some, I got to get, I had Dr. Hoppe sign a canvas print of a Mises, of a Hoppe meme. And I got to see him, like, he was so delighted when he saw it. And then Guido Holzmann was sitting there, and he explained to him in German, like, what he was citing. And, like, so that was just a lot of fun. I'm trying to think of some others. I mean, one of my favorite Mises stories that I've heard, I was able to spend a wonderful evening talking with Richard Ebeling, who was just such a fascinating individual. And he had this great story about Ludwig von Mises and Margaret Mises traveled to San Francisco to go to an event for IHS. And when they got picked up, they were driving through, like, the red light district of San Francisco. And Margaret was seeing all these strip clubs, and she was aghast at this, and she told Lou, like, Lou, do you see this? Topless, bottomless. And the way the story is told is that Mises, you know, thought about this and said, very bad for the textile industry. And that's one of my favorite Mises stories.
Oh, Broadway. I'm from right outside of San Francisco, so I know exactly where that's at.
Yeah, no, it's some of the best personalities of the Institute. You wouldn't know if you're there. Like, one of the things I think that people would never appreciate about the Institute is, like, we are a woman-driven institute.
Sure.
Like, most of the staff are women. The Pat Barnett, who still is our vice president, she recently retired in her daily roles. I mean, she was the foundation of the Institute. I mean, you know, I've been so blessed to be able to talk to Marty Rockwell, and they talk about back in the day when, you know, they would save paper clips and how much of a shoestring budget they had. And yet they had someone who was a donor that came in and wanted to talk more about investing. And so, like, they all, you know, all the women got together, and they cooked them a nice, like, home meal. And it was Marty Rockwell, and it was Pat Burnett. And like, that was the foundation of the Institute, was people that had no money, that were saving, budgeting everything, and just had the opportunity through the sheer brilliance of Lou Rockwell and some of the young scholars that were attracted, able to build the most important organization in terms of publishing, preserving, promoting, and developing the ideas foundational to the development and preservation of civilization. And that's what Lou Rockwell is, the indispensable man of libertarian ideas in 20th century America. True. Without him being able to build the institution that he had, without billionaire money, be able to build that through hard work and sweat and giving off what was a very good publishing career, is one of the most heroic feats that for such a niche cause. I mean, try to imagine going out there and trying to sell the works of Ludwig von Mises in the world. They didn't care.
Right.
Lou Rockwell is a hero. And anyone who values the ideas of Mises or Rothbard or Hazlitt that doesn't love Lou Rockwell is an ingrate and sure. Doesn't deserve the ideas of Mises, right, and Rothbard and Hayek.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with you. There's some people out there who like to pull up old writings and old works and say, look,
now they're useless.
Look at this.
Pot shots. They're taking ill-informed, desperate pot shots at better men, and they should be laughed at and ignored. That's why history won't remember them, but the history will remember Lou Rockwell.
Sure. I definitely agree. I cannot disagree there, sir. Well, hey man, I really appreciate you coming on. Why don't you tell the good people watching where they can find Tho Bishop and give support at, man?
Yeah, well, you could find me at the Mises Institute. You can find me at Radio Rothbard. Well, we've had a little bit of a pause because of my co-host Ryan McMakin, but we're getting that up. I've been doing an experimental podcast with my buddy Ford Seuss, the surfing violinist, Redneck Riviera. And one of my new projects, with the blessing of Lou, is RothbardRockwellReport.com, where I am republishing the classic 90s paleo articles from the Triple R, as well as articles from Liberty Magazine and Chronicles. And I will be building out the intellectual sphere of paleo libertarianism, because I think it's a moment whose time has once again come back. So that's one of the things I'm really excited about. And again, at Tho Bishop, it's a weird name. And if anyone from your viewership ends up in the Redneck Riviera here in Bay County, Florida, I will happily buy anyone a drink. Just reach out to me on Twitter.
Yeah, and you got bars that are open, man, and you don't even got to wear a mask.
Yes.
Well, shit, man. Hey, I really appreciate you coming on. Like I said, I'm a big fan. I think that the work you're doing is invaluable, even if you chose a party I don't agree with all the time. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the beauty of the paleo strategy. I'm trying to. I'm not trying to kick you guys out. I'm trying to win you guys over. So that's the fun I get to have the next few years.
Rad. Well, hey, man. Thanks again for coming on, and we'll definitely see you later, brother.
Excellent. Later, man.
All right, guys. Another awesome show. Break the Cycle. Tho's the man. Definitely go check him out. Follow him. Go to the Mises Institute. Check out everything they have to offer. I know that the next item I will be getting on my shelves back here somewhere is going to be the Mises bust that you can order on the store on Mises Institute. It's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. I need to get it. I will eventually. It's a little expensive, but I'll get there. Once again, let's make sure we check out lorenzotti.coffee for all your delicious Italian coffee needs delivered directly to your door. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. Of course, toplobster.com, the man, the myth, the legend, one of the coolest people in the movement. You guys are going to start getting to see him a lot more as like a person. He's doing a lot more podcasts. And in fact, we just booked the day after the 4th of July, July 5th, will be a special episode of Couch Dreams with me and your boy, Top Lobster. I'm very excited. He also just put out this cool custom Break the Cycle pillow. You can now take a piece of the Couch Dream set and have it at your house. Go to toplobster.com, use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. And Anthem Planning, executive producers of the show, anthemplanning.com. Check them out. Emergency crisis planning for your business, personal, home, whatever you need them for. Check them out. Amy Lepore is awesome. You should be doing anything that you need through them for your business. Let's see. Coming up on Friday, we're going to have the man, JJ Boogie, the guitarist from Arrested Development, on the show. I'm so excited for this, man. He is, not only is he like one of the coolest guys I've ever talked to online, he's also got that beard, man. That beard is so, it gives me beard envy. Check out the, you can listen to this podcast, by the way. If you don't have time to watch it live, you can listen to it on all your favorite podcast apps. We're averaging like over 1,500 listens per week right now, which is really awesome for a show that's only been around a little over 2 months. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you guys supporting Break the Cycle. But if you would like to financially support Break the Cycle, please check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/breakthecyclejs, or subscribestar.com/ Break the Cycle JS. There's some really cool tiers there. You can get some pretty cool gear, Top Lobster drawn gear. There's a mug club. I did steal that from Steven Crowder. I'm not ashamed to say it. And also, I was going to say something else to you guys, and I can't remember what it was. Terrible. But anyways, I will see you guys Friday. Until then, don't forget to break the cycle.
Due to legal reasons, I just have to explain. The lyrics of my last song may seem to contain a violent call to action in the verse and the frame, but I just spent it in Minecraft. The helicopter part was in reference to GTA 5 and the things you do. So any violence you commit, I am not an excuse, because I just spent it in Minecraft. Well, Chipper is my friend and he's constantly cold. Accusations of incitement getting totally old. Make your own choices, yeah, you have control, because I just meant it in Minecraft. Obviously, I would never advocate force, unless there's due process and a trial, of course. And if you're convicted, we will make you a corpse in Minecraft, just in Minecraft. You're nothing, I mean, you know it. No product.